Not to it, quite frankly. You've said a lot of things this morning, actually. I liked your talking about the Mennonite Heritage Sunday and the comments about the Mennonite pastor in Africa. That ties directly into what I have to say this morning. And, lawyers are probably unredeemable in a way, but they play a big part in the Jewish history and in our lives. At last count in the United States alone, there was 1 million lawyers, and there's only just over 200 million people. So they, like it or not, they're part of us, part of our society. My wife and I just came back from a trip to Mexico. And so as I prepared this talk, I couldn't help but look at the assigned readings, and this is lectionary readings that we looked at this morning. They're actually last week's lectionary readings, but Henry thought it best that I deal with them. And so I looked at these readings with Mexico on my mind, and I was in Mexico because we have our fourth child coming up in 2 months, and we thought we'd take a respite, Cynthia and I, from that. And we were visiting my friend Jeff Garchor, who was a former resident at the Menno Simon Center. And he is a political officer with the Canadian Foreign Service stationed in Mexico. So we spent some time in Mexico with him, and then we spent some time on the coast. And so, being a political officer, the issues in Leviticus, the political nature and the law and politics are intermingled. It's also Mennonite Heritage Sunday, as you pointed out. So I think my job, retainer today is to incorporate Leviticus, Matthew, Mexico, and really Latin America and Mennonites. When you are in Mexico, the two dominant features that are constantly front and center are the Catholic Church and the Revolution. There is in every major street, in every town, there is an avenue called Revolution Street or Plaza of the Insurrection. The other dominant feature found on each of these major streets or plazas is a Catholic church, a major Catholic church of historic nature dominating the horizon. There have been a number of revolutionary movements in Mexico over the years, and many years of political turmoil in that country. At different times, the Catholic Church has been caught out on the wrong side of the political fight, i.e. the losing side, and they have paid a heavy price. After one successful uprising in the 19th century, some 50 years before the actual revolution, what they call the revolution, the Catholic Church in Mexico lost most of their extensive land holdings. During the actual revolution, the Catholic Church was not on side with the revolutionary spirit and regarded by the new socialist government as suspicious. And the Catholic Church, of course, regarded the socialists as suspicious. The Catholic Church in Mexico, however, did not lose the adherence of its people. Today, actually, one of the people I was visiting with last week, he attends Mass. And I asked him, well, what's attendance at Mass? And he attended, there's Mass on the hour during a Sunday, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 1. And it takes a break and goes 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, packed all day. The political party that has dominated and ruled Mexico since 1910 until the recent election of Vicente Fox in 2000 is the PRI. And they are called, in English, the Institutional Revolutionary Party. And although there can be many different rebellions in Mexico that could qualify as a revolution, such as the removal of Spain in the early 1800s, the revolution, which is the front and center to Mexico in terms of their streets and to their ethos, is the one that occurred between 1910 and 1920. It was a reaction to the vast and growing disparity between the rich and the poor. This brings me to the late Pope John Paul II. After he died this year, there were many retrospectives dealing with his life, centering around the many images of him traveling the various regions of the world. One image that I vividly remember from his time, it was early in his term, and I saw again during one of the retrospectives, is the image of John Paul in a white robe landing in one of the new countries and standing before a Jesuit priest from Latin America. And as he's standing in his white robe, the Jesuit priest was kneeling before him. They normally kneel and kiss the ring. And John Paul stood there before him as he was kissing the ring and wagged his finger at him and told him, scolded him relentlessly in public, just at the airport, just as all the cameras were upon it. And this picture was in such sharp contrast with virtually all the other public images that I associate with the late John Paul. And in fact, in retrospect, this is really the only instance where I see him scolding. The priest's failing in the eyes of the Pope was his strong association with the liberation theology, and more particularly with the Sandinista guerrilla movement, and then the Sandinista government in Nicaragua. In total, there were about 4 Catholic priests that were ministers in the Sandinista government. The Pope, in making such a public demonstration of displeasure, wanted his displeasure to be known far and wide, I would think. And the Pope was a dramatist. Liberation theology doesn't come up very often in the Canadian context. We are generally not keen on words of revolution, or the idea of uncontrollable, rapid change. To give meaning to one of the main theological issues that play out in Latin America, in the Catholic Church, I've looked at a definition of liberation theology, and I think this is it. Liberation theology emerged in Latin America to challenge the Catholic Church's traditional role as defender of the status quo. It is the belief that the Christian Church has a duty and commitment to oppose social, economic, and political repression societies where exploitation and oppression exists. Jesus' message within this context is that of revolution, economic, social, and political. Jesus then is regarded as the ultimate revolutionary figure. The sight of John Paul taking the priest to task is interesting for 2 reasons as we now look at Leviticus. And we read Leviticus just earlier, it's on page 3. First, the story of Leviticus is the story of the Israeli people with God's direct intervention being released from social, economic, and political repression, which they were suffering as slaves in Egypt. Interesting, the story of liberation of the Jews, Leviticus, which has given inspiration and theological framework to the liberation theology movement. Starting at Leviticus 19, verse 1 and 2, the Lord said to Moses, "Speak to the entire assembly of Israel and say to them, 'Be holy, because I, the Lord your God, am holy.'" This verse, beginning of chapter 19, is followed from chapter 18, wherein there's a description of various ways in which one can do wrong, i.e. the law. In the end of chapter 18, there's a description how the Canaanites had so defiled themselves and so defiled the land which they lived, God's judgment was to remove them from it and give the land to Israel. But the condition for the Israelites was this. They were to keep the law, they were to keep themselves holy, or the land would be removed from them. It was a conditional gift of the land. Now, what's the standard? What's the holy standard that has to be met? Being holy for these ex-slaves means creating a peoplehood marked by justice, impartiality, righteousness, honesty, an openness to correction, lack of vindictiveness, and love. This is the message, then, the rest of the passage we're looking at in Leviticus. This is what Moses is told to say to the people of Israel, now free of slavery, now in the throes of creating their own society. This is what they must do to create a holy society. Chapter 19, starting at verse 15. And what I've quoted here may be different from what you have. I think my version is the NIV. Do not pervert justice. Do not show partiality to the poor or favoritism to the great, but judge your neighbor fairly. The laws in Leviticus are about creation of a holy society in a post-slave world, post-revolution. They're about how Israelis were going to be using their newfound freedom, their right of self-determination. With this freedom, they were called to do what other societies could or would not do. They were told by God to be just. This is interesting given the fact that while God's chosen people were led out with Egypt, They did so with God's intercession. In creating the law, the Justices, they were told, first, not to show partiality to the poor or favoritism to the great. Now, this in no way undermines or detracts from God's other laws and commands with respect to helping the poor or commitment to charity. But here we're talking about how justice can be perverted. Justice requires an even hand at all times, but it's never, never easy. In my practice, I constantly worry going to trial how my particular witness will be perceived. And this is beyond the issue of poor or great witnesses, or poor or great within our society. I make decisions whether to try or run the case on written material, or i.e. affidavit material, when I see that witnesses have attributes that are undesirable. My question to myself is a client likable? Does he or she have characteristics and patterns of speech that make it easy for the court to accept or dismiss their testimony? Last month I was in a trial arising from issues occurring 4 years earlier that concerned the price of gasoline between a dealer and supplier of gas. This case was settled after 5 days of trial, with a number of more days scheduled. Since the action was commenced, the price of gasoline, of course, has increased enormously. And by the time the trial came along, I was just beside myself for not having set the matter before a jury when the matter first came up. The case was a contract case, pure and simple. However, counsel for the supplier and I knew this was absolutely the wrong time for a gas supplier to bring their type of claim. Of course, the idea behind fairness and keeping even hand underlined much of the development of our legal system. There is a supposition that all are equal before the law. Verse 16. Do not go about slandering or spreading slander among your people. Do not do anything that endangers your neighbor's life. I am the Lord. Verse 17. Do not hate your brother in your heart. Rebuke your neighbor frankly so that you will not share in his guilt. Back to John Paul. The vision of John Paul rebuking his priest, his charge. Quite clearly, a pope has duties from an authoritarian perspective, or authoritative perspective, that we may not be so comfortable with. But as head of the Catholic Church, he does have a duty to ensure that the Church does not share in the guilt or harm that this pope perceived was occurring. He therefore rebuked this priest. I think there are a number of other ways of looking at this passage on how one can share the guilt of a neighbor. John Paul wanted in no uncertain terms to let it be known that he could not and would not condone the ideas and activities of this Jesuit priest. He did not want theological inconsistency in the church, and more importantly, and hence the public nature, I think, of his rebuke. He didn't want the very public activities of this priest to be associated with the beliefs and activities of the church. He did not want the church to share his guilt. Another way we can look at the issue of sharing guilt is if we let the problem or an issue fester that we have with a neighbor. The beginning of verse 17 starts with the admonition not to hate your brother in your heart. The longer the problem continues, the more it can personalize. Hating the sin can easily become hating the sinner. If it does, then surely we are sharing in the guilt. However, rebuking your neighbor is fraught with difficulties. While not speaking frankly, can and does lead to resentment and sin. An equally compelling concern regarding talking frankly to one's neighbor, i.e. taking someone to task, always begs these questions. Is this not going to make matters worse? And who am I to reprove? Various rabbis have considered this passage in Leviticus and have commented variously, but really with one theme. Is there anyone or there is no one in this or any other generation that is qualified to reprove. Reproof is a tricky business. Seemingly, you can be damned if you do, damned if you don't. And I don't have many answers here. Quite recently, MCC has committed itself to direct itself more regularly to speaking with a prophetic voice in matters traditionally viewed as political in nature. In particular, over the last number of years, MCC has written reviews and updates on the situation in Palestine with Israel. And these statements have been regarded by individuals very recently, and we've had a flurry of emails go around, in particular by various Jews, as being uneven, unfair, and obsessive in their singular attention to this issue. In particular, they object to the language that identifies Israel as the oppressor and the Palestinians as the correspondingly oppressed. At MCC board meetings, the MCC BC board meetings, I've always been somewhat uncomfortable about this sort of direction for MCC. I worry about our expertise and our limitations. However, I think the verse clearly asks us to speak up when we see something going wrong in our neighbor's life. I think that if we were to speak frankly as MCC, we should say something like this to Israel. While we appreciate you are in a tight spot, and your own neighbors have been exceedingly unfriendly over the years and continue to be so, you as ex-slaves in Egypt, the persecuted in Europe and elsewhere, we hold you to a higher standard. God holds you to a higher standard. We should cite Leviticus 19:34, where it states, "The alien living with you must be treated as one of your native born. Love him as yourself, for you were aliens in Egypt." We should make it clear that we are writing concerning Israel because we consider her our neighbor. We have not maintained that same sort of interest in other parts of this troubled world. A message can be right, but wrongly delivered. Nonetheless, this is just the tip of the iceberg in the ways of being criticized for being critical. As I said, this is an exceedingly difficult matter in practice. Clearly, if we are able to reprove individually or collectively, then a prerequisite has to be a clean heart and a clear conscience. Verse 18. "Do not seek revenge or bear a grudge against one of your people, but love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord." The Jesuit priest in question was Ernesto Cardenal, and he was a talented poet in addition to being a priest. He was originally a pacifist, but during the 1970s he changed his mind and found justification for armed struggle as a necessary and justifiable code of conduct within the context of the liberation of the oppressed. Ernesto aligned himself absolutely with the Sandinista during the guerrilla war and then served in cabinet when they achieved power. Now, the various Latin American civil wars were brutal, and unspeakable atrocities were met time and time again by escalating reprisals. I'm going to turn to Matthew. Matthew 22, Jesus is being harried by the lawyer types in Israel at the time. They want to use the law to trip up Jesus. Everybody that is a party to this conversation seems well aware of the law, and they start their questioning at Matthew 22:16 this way. "Teacher, we know you are a man of integrity, and that you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth, that you aren't swayed by men, because you pay no attention to who they are." This sounds vaguely familiar, doesn't it? Of course, it's a paraphrasing of Leviticus. But Jesus goes on to say regarding these same people that the law to them has become perverted. Of the teachers of the law and the Pharisees, he says, "Do as they say, not as they do. That their actions in accordance with the law is done simply for men to see." In other words, for their own self-gratification. At Matthew 23:23, Jesus says, "Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! you would give a tenth of your spices, mint, dill, and cumin. But you have neglected the most important matters of the law: justice, mercy, and faithfulness. He goes on to say, you blind guides. And this is the kicker. You strain out a gnat, but swallow a camel. God calls us to obey the law. And this is the law of the big L. But to pay greater attention to what really matters in following the law: justice, mercy, and faithfulness. To do this, one has to go back to the greatest commandments. These are the commandments in the law that underpin the law. They are the prism through which the law must be considered. Otherwise, it can and will be perverted. Matthew 23:37. And that's set out in our bulletin. Love your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. This is what Jesus says in answer to the question about what is the greatest commandment. Loving God, first and foremost, takes us out of purely temporal concerns. It tempers our goals, it sets our goals, it gives us perspective. The next verse in Matthew, then, verse 38, the second commandment. And the second is like it: love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments. Loving our neighbor does not allow us to dehumanize them, whether they are on another team, of a different culture, different religion, proponent of a different ism, or simply an annoyance. We are not entitled to dehumanize. We are told to love them. I would have to say that for the Catholic Church, the question of the importance of sanctity of life is directly related to this issue. Now, laudable goals manifest in virtually every movement or counter-movement, and they can and are used to justify horrific treatment of individuals. When we lose sight of God's commands, it's first and second greatest, to love each individual and treat each individual justly and without favor, enormous horrific treatment can result. I remember after 9/11, Dick Cheney was commenting that America was going to have to spend some time in the shadows. And I think he meant more than simply that they were going to have to increase their spy network. For instance, in their rush to bring terrorists to justice, the White House took their laws regarding torture and with the use of lawyers, where others saw roadblocks, they saw opportunity. Working under the premise that all things are permissible, except where specifically prohibited by law, they have parsed the law and found ways around the laws prohibiting torture to arguably, technically, allow for it. The rules are not regarded as a prohibition on torture, but the law becomes a means of allowing torture in certain times, in certain places, and in certain ways. The need to take revenge superseded the need to be just. And the justice is defined as fighting terror. Just like any other cause, the cause becomes more important than fairness to each person. Closer to home, occasionally in my own practice, I run into counsel who have decided that every step in the litigation process is an opportunity to gain an advantage for their clients. Their compliance with the rules of court becomes at times suspect, or at times seemingly slavish. And they can make a straightforward file exceedingly time-consuming, difficult, and emotionally trying. You call on them during these infractions, maybe even exchange some barbs in the courtroom to bring the attention of the matter to the judge. This is of usually very little and limited effect. Tell you what I feel like doing in those instances. I feel like waiting for an opportunity to arise and to give counsel a taste of their own medicine. However, I don't think I've been really able to do it. Not successfully. I'm not saying that other counsel necessarily regard me as a joy to practice against. However, to exact the revenge in the manner in which I practice would, the manner in which I would practice would have to change. I can't flick a switch and enact that revenge without it fundamentally changing my practice and changing me. Going back to Leviticus, and I think this is the third meaning of not sharing in the guilt of a neighbor. And I think this is the most appropriate look at it when looking at the entirety of the section in Leviticus and Matthew. I should not be changed by the sins of others. I should not allow myself to be dragged in and dragged down, seeking to make justice now. Now, does that mean we should live lives of cloistered virtue? Now, this is my nod to Mennonite Heritage Sunday. This has perpetually been our concern. But not, I have to say, the concern of where we are at this time and this place. We, individually and collectively, are in the game. Leviticus and Matthew call for us to do much. We're called to be virtuous, not cloistered. Now we are not slaves. We are free to pursue our own interests in a free society. Everything is permissible for me, but not everything is beneficial. I should incur no guilt because of a neighbor. I cannot take vengeance, bear a grudge, or hate. Instead, you and I are called first and foremost to have our goals defined by our love of God, and in turn to love our neighbor as ourselves. We must then let us have these commands and view the rest of our decisions. Thank you.